The moon was somewhere beyond the clouds, but Angua didn't need to see it. Kara had once had a special watch made for her birthday. It was a little moon that turned right around, black side and white side, every 28 days. It must have cost him a lot of money. And Angua now wore it on her collar, and the one item of clothing that she could wear all month round. She couldn't bring herself to tell him that she didn't need it. You knew when it was happening. It was hard to know much else right now, because she was thinking with her nose. That was the problem with the wolf times. The nose took charge. Currently, Angua was searching the alleys around Treacle Street, spiraling out from the dwarf mine. She prowled onwards in a world of color. Smells overlaid one another, drifting and persisting. The nose was also the only organ that can see backwards in time. She'd already visited the spoil heap on the waste ground. There was the smell of a troll there. It had got out that way, but there was no point in following a trail that cold. Hundreds of street trolls roared lichen and skulls these days, but the foul, oily stuff that was a smell that was clinging to her memory. The little devils must have some other way in, right? And you had to move the air around in a mine, right? So some trace of that oil would find its ways out along with the air. They probably wouldn't be strong, but she didn't need them to be. A trace of it was all she needed. It would be more than enough. As she padded through the alleys and leapt walls into midnight yards, she kept clenched in her jaws the little leather bag that was a friend to any thinking werewolf. Such a creature being defined as one who remembers that your clothes don't magically follow you. The bag held a lightweight silk dress and a large bottle of mouthwash, which Angua considered to be the greatest invention of the last 100 years. She found what she was looking for behind Broadway. It stood out against the familiar organic smells of the city as a tiny black ribbon of stench that left zigzags in the air as breezes and the passages of carts had dragged it this way and that. She began to move with more care. This wasn't an area like Treacle Street. People with money lived here, and they often spent their money on big dogs and disproportionate response signs in their driveways. As it was, she heard the rattle of chains and the occasional whine as she slunk along. She hated being attacked by large, ferocious dogs. It always left a mess, and the mouthwash was afterwards never strong enough. The threat of stink was floating through the railings of Empirical Crescent, one of the city's great architectural semi-precious gems. It was always hard to find people prepared to live there, however, despite the general desirable nature of the area. Tenants seldom stayed for more than a few months before moving hurriedly, sometimes leaving all their possessions behind. Empirical Crescent was just off Park Lane, in what was generally a high-rent district. The rents would have been higher still were it not for the continued existence of Empirical Crescent itself, which, despite the best efforts of Ankh-Morpork Historical Preservation Society, had still not been pulled down. This was because it had been built by Bergholt Stutley Johnson, better known to history as Bloody Stupid Johnson, a man who combined in one frail body such enthusiasm, self-delusion, and creative lack of talent that he was, in many respects, one of the great heroes of architecture. Only Bloody Stupid Johnson could have invented the 13-inch foot and a triangle with three right angles in it. Only Bloody Stupid Johnson could have twisted common matter through dimensions it was not supposed to go. And only Bloody Stupid Johnson could have done all this by accident. His highly original multidimensional approach to geometry was responsible for Empirical Crescent. On the outside, it was a normal terraced crescent of the period, built of honey-colored stone with the occasional pillar or cherub nailed on. Inside, the front door of number 1 opened into the back bedroom of number 15. The ground floor front window of number 3 showed the view appropriate to the second floor of number 9. and smoke from the dining room fireplace of number 2 came out the chimney of number 19. She sailed over the railing with silence and eased and landed on all fours on what had once been gravel path. Residents in the Crescent seldom did much gardening, since even if you planted bulbs, you could never be sure whose garden they'd come up in. Angua followed her nose to a patch of rampant thistles. Some molding bricks in a circle marked what must have been an old well. The oily stink was heavy here, but there was a fresher, far more complex smell that raised the hairs on Angua's neck. There was a vampire down there. Someone had pulled away the weeds and debris, including the inevitable rotting mattress and decomposing armchair. But it was okay to throw your rubbish into the garden, because it might not be your garden you were throwing it into. Sally? What was she doing here? Angua pulled a brick out of the rotted edging and let it drop. Instead of a splash, there was a clear wooden thump. Oh well. She went back to human to get down. Claws were fine, but some things were better done by monkeys. The sides were, of course, slimy, but so many bricks had fallen out over the years that the descent turned out to be easier than she'd expected. And it was only about 60 feet deep. Built in the days when it was widely believed that any water that supported so many little whiskery swimming things must be healthy. There were fresh planks in the bottom. Someone, and surely it could only have been the dwarfs, had broken into the well down here and laid a couple of planks across it. They had dug this far and stopped. Why? Because they'd reached the well? There was dirty water, or water-like liquid, just under the planks. The tunnel was a bit wider here, and dwarfs have been here. She sniffed. A day ago? No, more. Yes. Dwarfs have been here. Had fished around, and had then all left at once. They hadn't even bothered to tidy up. She could smell it like a picture. She crept forward, the tunnels mapping themselves in her nostrils. They weren't nicely finished, like the tunnels Ardent moved in. They were rougher, with lots of zigzags and blind alleys. Rough planks and bulks of timber held back the fetid mud of the plains, which was nevertheless oozing through everywhere. These tunnels weren't built to last. They were there for a quick and definitely dirty job, and all they had to do was survive until it was done. So, the diggers had been looking for something, but weren't sure where it was until they were within, about 20 feet of it, when they'd smelled it, detected it. The last stretch of the wall was dead straight. By then, they knew where they were going. Angua crept on, almost bending double to clear the low ceiling until she gave up and went back to Wolf. The tunnel straightened out, with the occasional side passage that she ignored, although they smelled long. The vampire smell was still an annoying theme in the nasal symphony, and it came close to drowning the reek of foul water oozing from the walls. Here and there, worms had colonized the ceiling. She had bats. They stirred. And then there was another scent as she passed the tunnel opening. It was quite faint, but it was unmistakably the whiff of corruption. A fresh death. Three fresh deaths. At the end of a short side tunnel were the bodies of three dwarfs, half buried in the mud. They glowed. Worms had no teeth, Kara had told her. They waited until the prospective meal became runny of its own accord. And while they waited for the biggest stroke of luck ever to have come their way, they celebrated. Down here, in a world far away from the streets, the dwarfs would dissolve in light. Angua sniffed. Make that very fresh. They found something, said a voice behind her. And then it killed them. Angua leapt. The leap wasn't intentional. Her hindbrain arranged it all by itself. The front brain, and the bit that knew that sergeants should not attempt to disembowel lance constables without provocation, tried to stop the leap in midair. But by then, simple ballistics were in charge. All she managed was a midair twist and struck the soft wall with her shoulder. wings fluttered a little way off, and there was a drawn-out, organic sound. A sound that conveyed the idea that a slaughterhouse man was having some difficulty with a tricky bit of gristle. "You know, Sergeant," said the voice of Sally, as if nothing had happened, "you werewolves have it easy. You say one thing, and you don't have any problems with bloody body mass. Do you know how many bats I have to become for my body weight? More than 150, that's how many. And there's always one, isn't there, that gets lost or flies the wrong way. You can't think straight unless you get your bats together. And I'm not even going to touch on the subject of reassimilation. It's like the biggest sneeze you can think of. Backwards." There was no point in modesty, not down here in the dark. Angua forced herself to change back, every brain cell piling in to upvote tooth and claw. Anger helped. "Why the hell are you here?" she said, when she had a mouth that worked. "I'm off duty," said Sally, stepping forward. "I thought I'd see what I could find." She was totally naked. "You couldn't have been so lucky," Angua growled. "Oh, I don't have your nose, Sergeant," said Sally with a sweet smile, "but I was using 150 pretty good flying ones, and they can cover a lot of ground." "I thought vampires could rematerialize their clothes," said Angua accusingly. "Otto Shriek can. Females can't. We don't know why. It's probably part of the whole underwired night dress business. That's where you score again, of course. When you're in 150 bat bodies, it's quite hard to remember to keep two of them carrying a pair of pants." Sally looked up at the ceiling inside. "Look, I can see where this is going. It's going to be about Captain Carrot, isn't it? I saw the way you were smiling at him. I'm sorry, we can be very personable. It's a vampire thing. You were so keen to impress him, eh?" "And you aren't? He's the kind of man anyone would want to impress." They watched each other warily. "He is mine, you know," said Angua, feeling the nascent claws strain under her fingernails. "You're his, you mean," said Sally. "You know it works like that. You trail after him." "I'm sorry, it's a werewolf thing," Angua yelled. "Hold it." Sally thrust both hands in front of her in a gesture of peace. "There is something we better sort before this goes any further." "Yeah?" "Yes, we're both wearing nothing. We're standing in what, you may have noticed, is increasingly turning into mud. And we're squaring up to fight." "Okay. But there's something missing, yes? And that is a paying audience?" "We could make a fortune," Sally winked. "Or we could do the job we came here to do." Angle forced her body to relax. She could have been saying that. She was the sergeant, wasn't she? All right," she said. "We're both here, okay? Let's leave it at that. Were you saying that these dwarfs were killed by some thing from the well?" "Possibly. But if they were, it used an axe," said Sally. "Take a look. Scrape some of the mud away. It's been oozing over them since I arrived. That's probably why you missed it," she added generously. Angua hauled one dwarf out of the shining slime. "I see," she said, letting the body fall back. "This one hasn't been dead 2 days. Not much effort made to hide them, I see." "Why bother? They've stopped pumping out these tunnels. The props look pretty temporary. The mud's coming back. Besides, who'd be stupid enough to come down here?" A piece of wall slithered down with a stinky, organic cowpat sort of noise. Little plops and trickles filled the tunnel. Ankh-Morpork's underworld was stealthily reclaiming its own. Angua closed her eyes and concentrated. The slime rink, the vampire smell, and the water that was now ankle-deep all jostled for attention. But this was competition time. She couldn't let a vampire take the lead. That would be so traditional. "There were other dwarfs," she muttered. "Four more, I'm getting. The black oil. Distant blood. Down the tunnel." She stood up so sharply that she nearly hit her head on the tunnel roof. "Come on. It's getting a bit unsafe. We could solve this. Come on." "You can't be afraid of dying." Angua plunged away. "And you think spending a few thousand years buried in sludge is likely to be fun?" shouted Sally. But she was talking only to dripping mud and fetid air. She hesitated a moment, groaned, and followed Angua. Further along the main tunnel, there were more passages branching off. On either side, rivers of mud, like cool lava, were already flowing out of them. Sally splashed past something that looked like a huge copper trumpet, churning gently on the current. The tunnel was better built here than the ones near the well, and there, at the end of it, was a pale light. An Angua crouched by one of the big round dwarf doors. Sally paid her no attention. She barely glanced at the dwarf slumped with his back against the bottom of the door. Instead, she stared at the symbol scrawled large on the metal. It was big and crude. It might be a round, staring eye with a tail, and it gleamed with the greeny-white glow of worms. "He wrote it in his blood," said Angua without looking up. "They left him for dead. But he was only dying, you see. He managed to make it to here, but the killers had shut the door. He scratched at it, smelled here, and he's worn away his fingernails. Then he made that sign in his own warm blood and sat here, holding the wound shut, watching the worms turn up. I'd say he's been dead for 18 hours or so, I think we should get out of here right now," said Sally, backing away. "Do you know what that sign means? I know it's my sign, that's all. Do you know what it means?" "No. But I know it's one of the really bad ones. It's not good seeing it here. What are you doing with that body?" Sally backed away further. "Trying to find out who he was," said Angua, searching the dwarf's clothing. "It's the sort of thing we do in the watch. We don't stand around getting worried about drawings on the wall. What's the problem?" "Right now," said the vampire, "he's oozing a bit. If I can stand it, so can you. You see a lot of blood in this job. Don't attempt to drink it, that's my advice," said Angua, still rummaging. "Ah, he's a good rune neck. He's got a rune necklace. And..." She pulled a hand out of the dead dwarf's jerkin. "Can't make this out very well, but I can smell ink, so it may be a letter." "Okay, let's get out of here," she stood up. "Did you hear me?" "The sign was written by someone dying," said Sally, still keeping her distance. "Well, it's probably a curse. So, we didn't kill him," said Angua, getting to her feet with some difficulty. They looked down at the liquid mud now rising to their knees. "Do you think it cares?" said Sally matter-of-factly. "No, but I think there may be another way out in that last tunnel we passed," said Angua, looking back along the tunnel. She pointed. Scuttling along with blind determination, a line of worms marched along the dripping roof almost as fast as the mud flowed down below. They were heading into the side tunnel in a glowing stream. Sally shrugged. "It's worth a try, yes?" They left, and the sound of their splashing soon died away. Slowly, the mud rose, rustling in the gloom. The trail of worms gradually disappeared overhead. The worms that made the sign remained, though, because such a feast as this was worth dying for. Their glow winked out, one insect at a time. The darkness beneath the world caressed the sign, which flamed red and died. Darkness remained. On this day in 1802, the painter Methodia Rascal tried putting the thing under a heap of old sacks, in case it woke up the chicken, and finished the last troll, using his smallest brush to paint the eyeballs. It was 5 a.m. Rain rustled out the sky, not hard, but with a gentle persistence. In Seder Square and in the Plaza of Broken Moons, it hissed on the white ash of the bonfires, occasionally exposing the orange glow, which would briefly sizzle and spit. A family of gnolls were sniffing around, each one dragging his or her little cart. A few officers were keeping an eye on them. Gnolls weren't choosy about what they collected, provided it didn't actually struggle, and even that then there were rumors. But they were tolerated. Nothing cleaned up the place like a gnoll. From here, they looked like little trolls, each with a huge compost heap on its back. That represented everything it owned, and mostly what it owned was rotten. Sam Vimes winced at the pain in his side. Just his luck. Two coppers injured in the entire damn affair, and he had to be one of them. Igor had done his best, but broken ribs were broken ribs, and it'd be a week or two before the suspicious green ointment made it much difference. His hand twinged in sympathy with them, too. Still, he enjoyed a bit of warm glow about the whole thing. They had used good old-fashioned policing, and since good old-fashioned policemen are invariably outnumbered, he'd employed the good old-fashioned police method of cunning, deceit, and any damn weapon you could lay your hands on. It had hardly been a fight at all. The dwarfs had mostly been sitting and singing gloomy songs, because they fell over when they tried to stand up, or had tried to stand up and were now lying down and snoring. The trolls were, on the other hand, mostly upright, but went over when you pushed them. One or two, a little clearer in the head than the others, had put up a ponderous and laughable fight, but had fallen to that most old-fashioned of police methods, the well-placed boot. Well, most of them had. Vime shifted to ease the aching in his side. He should have seen that one coming. But all's well that ends well, eh? No deaths at all. And just to put a little cherry on the morning cake, he had in his hand an early morning edition of the Times, in which a leading article deplored the gangs stalking the city, and wondered if the watch was up to the job of cleaning up the streets. Well, yes, I think we are, you pompous twerp. Vime struck a match on a plinth and lit a cigar in recognition of a petty but darkly satisfying triumph. Gods knew they needed one. The watch had taken a pounding over the whole damn Coombe Valley thing, and it was good to hand the lad something to be proud of for a change. All in all, it was definitely a result. He stared at the plinth. He didn't remember what statue had once been there. It celebrated generations of graffiti artists now. A piece of troll graffiti adorned it now, obliterating everything done by the artists who used mere paint. He read, "Mr. Shine, him diamond. Mind sign, scrawl, city scrawl," he thought. Thing go bad, and people are moved to write on the walls, "Commander." He turned. Captain Carrot, armor gleaming, was hurrying toward him, his face, as usual, radiating an expression of 100% pure keen. "I thought I told everyone not on prisoner duty to get some sleep, Captain," said Vimes. "Just clearing up a few things, sir," said Carrot. "Lord Veterinary sent a message down to the yard. He wants a report. I thought I'd better tell you, sir." "I was just thinking, Captain," said Vimes expansively, "should we put up a little plaque? Something simple. It could say something like, 'Battle of Coombe Valley not fought here. Gruen the Fifth, Year of the Prawn.' Could we get them to do a bloody stamp? What do you think?" "I think you need to get some sleep yourself, Commander," said Carrot. "And technically, it isn't Coombe Valley until Saturday. Of course, monuments to battles that didn't take place might be stretching things a bit, but a stamp. Lady Sybil really worries about you, sir," Carrot broadcast concern. The fizz in Vimes' head subsided. As if awakened by this reference to Sybil, the debtors of his body queued up to waive their overdue IOUs. Feet, dead tired, in need of a bath. Stomach, gurgling. Ribs, on fire. Back, aching. Brain, drunk on its own poisons. Bath, sleep, eat. Good ideas. But still, must do things. "How's our Mr. Pessimal?" he said. "Igor's fixed him up, sir. He's a bit amazed at all the fuss. Now, I know I can't order you to go and see his lordship." "No, you can't, because I am a commander, Captain," said Vimes, still fuzzily intoxicated on exhaustion. "But he can, and he has, sir. And your coach will be waiting for you outside the palace when you come out." "That's Lady Sybil's orders, sir," said Carrot, appealing to higher authority. Vimes looked up at the ugly bulk of the palace. Suddenly, clean sheets seemed such a sweet idea. "Can't face him like this," he murmured. "I had a word with Secretary Drumnut, sir. Hot water, a razor, and a big cup of coffee will be waiting in the palace." "You thought of everything, Carrot." "I hope so, sir. Now off you—" "But I thought of something, eh?" said Vimes, swaying cheerfully. "Better dead drunk than just dead, eh?" "It was a classic ruse, sir," said Carrot reassuringly. One for the history books. "Now, off you go, sir. I'm going to have a look for Angua. She hasn't slept in her bed. But at this time of month, I know, sir, she hasn't slept in her basket either." In a dank cellar that once was an attic and was now half full of mud, the worms poured out of a small hole where wooden planks had long since worn away. A fist punched up, soggy timbers split and crumbled. Angua pulled herself up into this new darkness, then reached down to help Sally, who said, "Well, here's another fine mess." "Let's hope so," said Angua. "I think we need to go up at least one more level. There's an archway here. Come on." There have been too many dead ends, forgotten stinking rooms, and false hopes, and altogether too much slime. After a while, the smell became almost tangible, and then it managed to become just another part of the darkness. The women wondered and scrambled from one dripping, fetid room to another, testing the muddy walls for hidden doors, searching for even a pinprick of light in the ceilings hanging with interesting but horrible growths. Now they heard music. 5 minutes waiting and slithering brought them to a blocked-in doorway. But since it had been filled by the more modern Ankh-Morpork mortar of sand, horse dung, and vegetable peelings, several bricks had already fallen out. Sally removed most of the rest with one punch. "Sorry about that," she said. "It's a vampire thing." The cellar behind the demolished wall had some barrels in it, and looked as though it was regularly used. There was a proper door, too. Rather dull, repetitive music filtered down from between the boards. There was a trap door in them. "Okay," said Angua. "There's people up there. I can smell them. I count 57 hearts beating," said Sally. Angua gave her a look. "You know, that's one particular talent I'd keep to myself if I was you," she said. "Sorry, Sergeant. It's not the sort of thing people want to hear," Angua went on. "I mean, I personally am quite capable of crushing a man's skull in my jaws, but I don't go around telling everyone." "I shall make a note of it, Sergeant," said Sally, with a meekness that was quite possibly feigned. "Good. Now, what do we look like? Swamp monsters?" "Yes, Sergeant. Your hair looks dreadful, just like a green lump of slime." "Green? I'm afraid so. And my emergency dress is back down there somewhere," said Angua. "It's passed on, too. Can you go bats now?" "In daylight? 150 disoriented bits of me?" "No, but you could get out as a wolf, couldn't you?" "I'd kind of prefer not to be a slime monster coming through the floor, if it's all the same to you," said Angua. "Yes, I can see that. It does not pay to advertise." Sally flicked away a lump of nameless ooze. "Ugh, this stuff is foul. So the best we can hope for is that when we make a run for it, no one will recognize us," said Angua, pulling a lump of wobbly green stuff from her hair. "At least we..." "Oh no, what's wrong?" said Sally. "Nobby Nobbs, he's up there. I can smell him." She pointed urgently at the boards overhead. "You mean Corporal Nobbs, the little man with the spots?" said Sally. "We're not under a watch house, are we?" said Angua, looking around in panic. "I don't think so. Someone's dancing by the sound of it. But look, how can you smell one human in the middle of all this?" "It never leaves you, believe me." The smell of old cabbage, acne ointment, and non-malignant skin disease became transmuted in Corporal Nobbs into a strange odor that lay across the nose like a saw blade on a harp. It wasn't bad, as such, but it was like its host. Strange, ubiquitous, and hellishly difficult to forget. "Well, he's a fellow officer, isn't he? Won't he help us?" said Sally. "We are naked, Lance Constable. Only technically. This mud really sticks. I mean, underneath the mud," said Angua. "Yes, but if we had clothes on, we'd be naked underneath them, too," Sally pointed out. "This is not the time for logic. This is the time for not seeing Nobby grinning at me." "But he's seen you when you're wolf-shaped, hasn't he?" said Sally. "So?" snapped Angua. "Well, technically you're naked then, aren't you?" "Never tell him that." Nobby Nobbs, a shadow in the warm red gloom, nudged Sergeant Cullen. "You don't have to keep your eyes shut, Sarge," he said. "It's all legit. It's an artistic celebration of the female body, Tawny says. Anyway, she's got clothes on. Two tassels and a folded hanky. It is not clothes, Nobby," said Fred, sinking down in his seat. "The Pink Pussycat Club. Now, fair is fair. He'd been in the army and watch. And you couldn't spend all that time in uniform without seeing a thing or two. Or three," now he came to recollect. And it was true, as Nobby had pointed out, the ballerinas down at the opera house didn't leave a lot to the imagination, at least not to Nobby's. But when all was said and done, ballet had to be art, even though it was a bit short on plinths and urns, on account of being expensive to look at, and moreover, ballerinas didn't whiz around upside down. And the worst of it, he'd already spotted two people he knew in the audience. Fortunately, they hadn't seen him, which was to say that whenever he'd sneaked a glance their way, they were looking in completely the opposite direction. "Now, this bit is really hard," whispered Nobby conversationally. "Or is it?" Fred Cullen closed his eyes again. "Oh yes, it's the triple corkscrew. Look, don't the management object to you coming in here?" Fred managed, shifting even further down in his seat. "Oh no, they like having a watchman in," said Nobby, still watching the stage. "They say it makes people behave. Anyway, I only come in so as I can walk Betty home." Betty Bean. Tawny's actual name. Actually, only her pole name, Navi said. She says no one would be interested in an exotic dancer with a name like Betty. She says it sounds like she'd be better with a bowl of cake mixture. Colin shut his eyes, trying to banish a mental conjunction of the bronze lithe figure on stage and a bowl of cake mixture. I think I could do with a breath of fresh air, he groaned. Oh, not yet, Sarge. Broccoli's on next. She can touch the back of her head with her foot, you know. I don't believe that, said Fred Cullen. She can, Sarge. I don't believe there's a dancer called Broccoli. Well, she did used to be called Candy, Sarge. But then she heard that broccoli is better for you. Corporal Knobs. The sound appeared to be coming from under the table. Nobby stared at Fred Cullen and then looked down. Yes, he ventured with caution. This is Sergeant Angua, said the floor. Oh, said Nobby. What is this place? The voice continued. The Pink Pussycat Club, Sergeant, said Nobby obediently. Oh, gods, there was some conversation down below, and then the voice said, are there women up there? Yes, Sarge, or what are you doing down there, Sarge? Giving you orders, Nobby, said the voice from below. Are there women up there? Yes, Sarge, lots. Good. Please ask one to come down into the beer cellar. We'll need a couple of buckets of warm water and some towels. Got that? Nobby was aware that the musicians had stopped playing and Tawny had paused in mid-drop and split. Everyone was listening to the talking floor. Yes, Sergeant, said Nobby. I've got it. And some clean clothes. And there was subterranean whispering. Make that several buckets of water and a scrubbing brush and a comb and another comb. And more towels. Oh, and two pairs of shoes, size 6 and 4.5. Really? Okay. And is Fred Cullen with you, or is that a stupid question? Fred cleared his throat. I'm here, Sergeant, he reported. But I only came along to... Good. I want to borrow a set of your stripes. I've got a bad feeling about the next few hours. And I don't want anyone to forget I'm a sergeant. Got that? The pair of you? It's full moon, Fred whispered to Nobby, as one man to another. And then he said aloud... Yes, Sergeant, this may take a while. No, it won't, because you've got a werewolf and a vampire down here, understand? I'm having a really bad hair day, and she's got a toothache. We come up in 10 minutes looking human, or we come up anyway. What? There was more whispering. What? Why a beetroot? Why? In God's name, is a girly show likely to contain a beetroot? What? Okay, will an apple do? Nobby, Lance Constable von Humperdinck needs an apple, urgently, or something else that she can bite. Now, jump to it. Coffee was only a way of stealing time that should by rights belong to your slightly older self. Vimes drank 2 cups and had a wash and at least an attempt at a shave, which made him feel quite human if he ignored the sensation that parts of his head were stuffed with warm cotton wool. At last, deciding that he felt as good as he was going to, and could probably handle quite long questions, he was ushered into the oblong office of the Patrician of Ankh-Morpork. Ah, Commander, said Lord Veterinary, looking up after a considered interval and pushing aside some paperwork. Thank you for coming. It seems that congratulations are in order, so I am told. And why is that, sir, said Vimes, putting on his special blink, talking to Veterinary Face. Come now, Vimes. Yesterday, it looked as if we would be having a species war right in the middle of the city, and suddenly we are not. Those gangs were quite fearsome, I gather. Most of them were asleep or squabbling among themselves by the time we arrived, sir. We just had to tidy them away, Vimes volunteered. Yes, indeed, said Veterinary. It was quite astonishing, really. Do sit down, by the way. It really is not necessary for you to stand in front of me like a corporal or on a charge. Don't know what you mean, sir, said Vimes, collapsing gratefully into a chair. You don't? I was referring, Vimes, to the speed with which both parties managed to incapacitate themselves with strong liquor at the same time. I wouldn't know anything about that, sir. That was an automatic reaction. It made life simpler. No? It appears, Vimes, that while stealing themselves for the fracas to come, both the trolls and the dwarfs came into possession of what I assume they thought was beer. They have been on the been drinking all day, sir, Vimes pointed out. Indeed, Vimes, and possibly that is why the dwarf contingent, were less than cautious in drinking copiously from the beer that had been considerably fortified. Areas of Seder Square, I gather, still smell faintly of apples. Vimes. One could come to believe, therefore, that what they were drinking was, in fact, a mixture of strong beer and scumble, which is, as you know, distilled from apples. Mostly apples, sir, said Vimes, hopefully. Quite. The cocktail is known as Fluff. I believe, as to the trolls, one might speculate that it would be very hard to find anything to make their beer even more dangerous than it palpably is. But I wonder if you have heard, Vimes, that in an admixture of various metallic salts produces a drink known as Luglar, or Big Hammer. Can't say I do, sir. Vimes, some of the flagstones in the plaza have actually been etched by the stuff. Sorry about that, sir. Ventnary jumped his fingers on the table. What would you do if I asked you an outright question, Vimes? I tell you a downright lie, sir. Then I will not do so, said Ventnary, smiling faintly. Thank you, sir. Nor will I. Where are your prisoners? We spread them around the watch house yards, said Vimes. As they wake up, we hose them clean, take their names, give them a receipt for their weapon and a hot drink, and push them out into the street. Their weapons are culturally very important to them, Vimes, said Ventnary. Yeah, sir, I know. I myself have a strong cultural bias against getting my brains bashed in and my knees cut off, said Vimes, stifling a yawn and wincing as his ribs objected. Indeed. Were there any causalities in the battle? None that won't heal, Vimes grimaced. I have to report that Mr. A. Pessimal sustained a broken arm and multiple bruises, though. Ventnary actually looked taken aback. The inspector? What was he doing? Attacking a troll, sir. I'm sorry? Mr. A. Pessimal attacked a troll? Yes, sir. A. E. Pessimal? Ventnary repeated. That's the man, sir. A whole troll? Yes, sir. With his teeth, sir. Mr. A. E. Pessimal? You are sure? Small man, very clean shoes. Yes, sir. Ventnary grabbed a helpful question from the gathered throng. Why? Vimes coughed. Well, sir, the troll mob was a tableau. Trolls stood or sat or lay. When they had been where they had been when the big hammer had struck, there were a few slow imbibers who put up a bit of a fight, and who had stuck with a bottle of looted sherry, put up a spirited last drop stand, until Gollum Constable Dorful picked him up bodily and bounced him on his head. Vimes walked through it all, as the squad dragged or rolled slumbering trolls into neat lines to await the wagons, and then the day was not improving for Brick. He'd drunk a beer, well, maybe more than one. Where was Derharmond at? And now, Der, right in front of him, wearing one of them helmets and everything, could be a dwarf, insofar as the fizzing, sizzling pathways of his brain were capable of deciding anything at all. What der hell, they decided. It wasn't a troll, and that was what it was all about, right? And here was his club, right here in his hand. Instinct caused Vimes to turn as a troll opened red eyes, blinked, and began to swing a club. Too slowly in the suddenly frozen time, he turned to dive away, and he felt the club smash into his side and lift him up and tip him onto the ground. He could hear shouting as the troll lumbered forward, club raised again to make Vimes at one with the bedrock. Brick became aware that he was being attacked. He stopped when he was doing what he was doing, and, with sparks going fizzle in his brain, looked down his right knee. Some little gnome or something was attacking him with a blunt sword and kicking and screaming like a mad thing. He put it down to the drink, like after feeling that his ears were giving off flame, and brushed derfing away with a flip of his hand. Vimes, helpless, saw A. Pessimal tumble across the plaza and watched the troll turn back to the clubbing at hand. But Detritus, arriving behind it now, pulled it around with one shovel-sized hand, and here came the Detritus fist, like the wrath of gods. For Brick, everything went dark. You wish me to believe, said Lord Ventnary, that Mr. A. E. Pessimal single-handedly attacked a troll. Both hands, sir, said Vimes. And feet, too, and tried to bite it, we think. Isn't that certain death, said Ventnary? That didn't seem to worry him, sir. Vimes had last seen A. E. Pessimal being bandaged by Igor and smiling in a semi-conscious way. Watchmen were dropping in all the time to say things like, "Hi, big man," and slap him on the back. The world had turned for A. Pessimal. "Might I inquire, Vimes, why one of my most conscientious and most decidedly civilian clerks was in a position to do this?" Vimes shifted uncomfortably. "He was inspecting, learning all about us, sir." He gave Veterinary a look that said, "If you take this any further, I will have to lie." Veterinary returned one that said, "I know." "You yourself are not too badly injured," said the patrician said aloud. "Just a few scratches, sir." Veterinary gave him a look that said, "Broken ribs, I'm certain of it." Vimes returned one that said, "Nothing." Veterinary wandered over to the window and stared down at the waking city. He didn't speak for some time, and then let out a sigh. "Such a shame, I think, that so many of them were born here," he said. Vimes stuck with saying nothing. Generally sufficed. "Perhaps I should have taken action against the wretched dwarf," Veterinary went on. "Yes, sir." "You think so? A wise ruler thinks twice before directing violence against someone because he does not approve of what they say." Once again, Vimes did not comment. He himself directed violence daily and with a certain amount of enthusiasm against people because he didn't approve of them saying things like, "Give me all your money," or, "What are you going to do about it, copper?" But perhaps rulers had to think differently. Instead, he said, "Someone else didn't, sir." "Thank you for that, Vimes," said the patrician, turning around sharply. "And have you found out who they are yet?" "Investigations are continuing, sir. Last night's affairs got in the way." "Is there any evidence that it was a troll?" "There is puzzling evidence, sir. We are assembling a jigsaw, you might say. Except that we haven't got any of the edges, and it'd help if we had the lid of the box," he added to himself. And because Veterinary's face bore a hungry look, Vimes continued aloud, "If you're expecting me to pull a magic rabbit out of my helmet, sir, it'll be a cooked one. The dwarfs are certain it was a troll. There's a thousand years of history telling them. They don't need proof. And the trolls don't think it was a troll, but probably wish it was. This isn't about a murder, sir. Someone's inside him. Something inside him's gone click, and it's time for all good men, well, you know what I mean, to fight Coombe Valley all over again. Something else is going on in that mind. I know it. Something bigger than murder. All those tunnels. What are they for? All those lies. I can smell lies, and the place is full of them. Much hangs on this, Vimes," said Veterinary. "It's bigger than you know. I have this morning had a clax from Rise-Rison, the Low King. All politicians have their enemies, of course. There are, shall we say, factions that disagree with him, his policy toward us, his conciliatory approach to the troll clans, his stance on the whole wretched hawk thing. And now there are stories about a troll killing a grag, and, yes, rumors that the watch has threatened the dwarfs." Veterinary held up a pale hand as Vimes opened his mouth to protest. "We need to know the truth, Vimes. Commander Sam Vimes's truth. It may count for more than you think. In the plains, certainly. And much further. People know about you, Commander. Descendant of a watchman who believe that if a corrupted court will not behead an evil king, then the watchman should do it himself." "It was only one king," Vimes protested. "It wasn't a habit." "Sam Vimes once arrested me for treason," said Veterinary calmly. "And Sam Vimes once arrested a dragon. Sam Vimes stopped a war between nations by arresting two high commands. He's an arresting fellow, Sam Vimes. Sam Vimes killed a werewolf with his bare hands and carries laws with him, like a lamp. Where did all that come from?" "Watchmen across half the continent will say that Sam Vimes is as straight as an arrow, can't be corrupted, won't be charmed, never took a bribe. Listen to me. If Rise falls, the next Low King will not be one who is prepared to talk to the trolls. Can I make it simple for you? Those clans whose leaders have been dealing with clans whose leaders have been dealing with Rise will all, in all likelihood, feel they have been made fools of, overthrow said leaders, and replace them with trolls too belligerent and stupid to be fools. And there will be a war, Vimes. It'll come here. It won't be a gang crumble such as you thwarted last night. We won't be able to hold fast or stand aloof, because we have our own fools, Vimes. As I'm sure you know, who will insist we pick sides. Coombe Valley will be everywhere. Find me a murderer, Vimes. Hound them down and bring them into the daylight. Troll or dwarf or human, it doesn't matter. Then, at least, we shall have the truth and can make use of it. It is rumor and certainty that that is our enemy now. The Low King's throne trembles, Vimes, and thus do the foundations of the world. Veterinary paused and carefully squared up the paperwork in front of him, as if he now felt he'd gone too far. However, obviously I do not wish to put you under any kind of pressure, he finished. And Vimes' confused, lukewarm brain, one word bobbed to the surface. Crumble? Lord Veterinary's secretary leaned down and whispered into his master's ear. Ah, I believe I meant rumble. Said Veterinary brightly. Vimes was still trying to cope with International News Digest. All this over one murder, he said, trying to stifle a yawn. No, Vimes, you said it yourself. All this over thousands of years of tension in politics and power struggles. In recent years, things have gone in certain ways, causing power to shift. There are those who would like it to shift back, even if it returns on a tide of blood. Who cares about one dwarf? But if his death can be turned into a casus belli. Here, Veterinary looked at Vimes' sleepy eyes and went on. That is a reason for war. Then suddenly he is the most important dwarf in the world. When did you last get some proper sleep, Vimes? Vimes muttered something about not long ago. Go and have some more, and then find me the murderer, quickly. Good day to you. Not just thrones trembling, Vimes managed to think. Your chair is wobbling a bit, too. Pretty soon, some people will be saying, who let all these dwarfs in here? They undermine our city, and they don't obey our laws. And the trolls? We used to chain them up like guard dogs, and now they're allowed to walk around threatening real people. They'd be gathering now. The plotters. The people who chatted quietly in the corner at parties. The people who know how to fashion opinions into knives. Last night's little fray had been turned into a joke that had probably dismayed the party people. But you couldn't do it twice. Once things began to spread, once a few humans had been killed, you wouldn't need to talk behind closed doors anymore. The mob would scream on your behalf. They undermine our city, and they don't obey our laws. He climbed in the coach on legs that were only marginally under his control, muttered an instruction to head for Sidopolis Yard, and fell asleep. It was still nighttime in the city of endless rain. It was never not nighttime. No sun rose here. The creature lay coiled in its alley. Something was seriously wrong. It had expected resistance. There is always resistance, and it always overcame it. But even now, when the invisible bustle of the city had slowed, there was no way in. Time and again it would be sure that it had found a point of control. Some tide of rage it could use. And time and again it would be slammed back here, into this dark alley where the gutters overflowed. This was not the usual kind of mind. The creature struggled, but no mind had ever beaten it yet. There was always a way. Through the ruin of the world, the troll staggers. Brick lurched out of Dolly Sister's watch house, clutching his head with one hand and the other, holding the bag that contained as many of his teeth as Detritus had been able to find. The sergeant had been very decent about that, Brick thought. Detritus had also explained to him exactly what would have happened to him had his second blow hit the human, graphically indicating that finding Brick's teeth would have been secondary to finding a head to put them in. He'd gone on to say, though, that there might be a place in the watch for any troll who could still stand up after a head full of big hammer. And maybe Brick might like to conduct his future behavior with an eye to this. So, Brick thought, insofar as the term could be applied to any brain activity within 2 days of Big Hammer, Their future was looking so bright that he had to walk along with his eyes almost shut. Although that was probably their big hammer again. But he'd heard the other trolls talking. And the watchman, too. All this stuff about a troll killing a dwarf down in that new mine. Now, Brick was still certain he hadn't killed no dwarf, even after half an ounce of scrape. He'd gone over and over it in what currently remained of his mind. Trouble was, their watch had all these tricks these days. They could tell what a guy had for dinner just by looking at his plate. And he'd lost a skull down there, too. He was sure of that. Like, they could just sniff it out. Sniff it and know it was him. Except it wasn't him, right? Because they said their troll dropped his club, and Brick still had his club. Because he hit that top watchman with it. So maybe that was what they call an alibi. Yes, despite the cerebral gurgling noise of the big hammer draining away from his higher brain functions, Brick suspected that it wasn't. And anyway, if they looked for a troll, what done their deed? And they find out I was there. Lost a skull and everything, and I say, okay, I was there, but I never lopped no dwarf. They'll say, oh yes, pulled her other one. It is having bells on. Right here and right now, Brick was feeling a very lonely troll. There was nothing for it. There was only one person who could help him with this one. It was too much thinking for one troll. Slinking through alleys pressed against walls, keeping his head down, avoiding every living creature, Brick sought out Mr. Shine. Angua decided to go straight to Pseudopolis Yard rather than a closer watch house. That was HQ, after all, and besides, she always kept a spare uniform in her locker. What was annoying was that Sally walked so easily in 6-inch heels. That was vampires for you. She had taken hers off and was carrying them. It was that or turn an ankle. The Pink Pussycat Club had a fairly limited choice of footwear. There wasn't much to choose from in the way of clothing, either. If by clothing you meant something that actually made an attempt to cover anything. Angua had been rather surprised that the stage wardrobe had included a female watch outfit. But with skimpy papier-mâché armor and a skirt that was too short to be any protection. Tawny had explained rather carefully that men sometimes like to see a pretty girl in armor. And to Angua, who'd found that men she was apprehending never looked very pleased to see her, this was food for thought. She'd settled for a sequined gold dress, which just didn't work. Sally had picked something simple and cut to the thigh in blue, which, of course, had become stunning the moment she put it on. She looked fabulous. So when Angua strode into the main office, slamming the big doors back, and there was a derisory wolf whistle, the unwise watchman found himself being pushed backward until he was slammed against the wall. He felt two sharp points pressing against his neck as Angua growled, "You want a wolf, do you?" "Say no, Sergeant Angua." "No, Sergeant Angua, you don't." I was probably mistaken then, was I? The points pressed a little harder. It was the man's mind. Steely talons were about to pierce his jugular. "Couldn't say for sure, Sergeant Angua." "My nerves are a tad stretched right now," Angua howled. "Hadn't noticed, Sergeant Angua. We're all a little bit on edge at the moment, wouldn't you say?" "That's ever so true, Sergeant Angua." Angua let the man's boot reach the ground. She put two black, shiny, and noticeably pointed heels into his unresisting hands. "Could you do me a really big favor, please, and take these back up to the Pink Pussy Club?" she said sweetly. "They belong to someone called Sherilee, I think. Thank you." She turned and looked over to the duty desk, where a carrot was watching her with his mouth open. Well aware of the stir she was causing, she walked up to the desk, past an audience of shocked faces, and threw a muddy necklace down onto the open incident book. four dwarfs murdered by other dwarfs down in the Long Dark, she said. I'll bet my nose on it. That belonged to one of them. He'd also got this one. A muddy envelope was dropped by the necklace. It's pretty slimy, but you can read it. Mr. Vimes is going to go postal. She looked up into the blue eyes of Carrot. Where is he? Sleeping on a mattress in his office, said Carrot, and shrugged. Lady Sybil knew he wouldn't go home, so she got Wilkins to make up a bed down here. Are you two all right? Fine, sir, said Sally. I was getting very worried, Carrot began. Four dead dwarfs, Captain, said Angua. City dwarfs, that's what you should be worrying about. Three half buried, this one crawled away. Carrot picked up the necklace and read the runes. Lars Legstrom, he said. I think I know the family. Are you sure he was murdered? Throat cut. It'd be hard to call it suicide, but he took some time to die. He made it to one of their damn doors, which they'd locked shut and scrawled one of their signs on it with his own blood. Then he sat down and waited to die in the dark. In the damn dark, Carrot. They were working dwarfs. They had shovels and wheelbarrows. They were down there doing a job, and when they weren't needed anymore, they got the chop. Hacked down, left for the mud. He might even still have been alive down there when Mr. Vimes and I went in. Behind their bloody thick door, dying by inches. And do you know what this means? She pulled a folded piece of card out of her bodice and passed it over. A drinks menu, said Carrot. Open it, snapped Angua. I'm sorry, it's written in lipstick. It was all we could find. Carrot flipped it open. Another dark symbol, he said. I don't think I know this one. There were other dwarf officers in the office. Carrot held up the symbol. Does anyone here know this? What this means? A few helmeted heads shook, and a few dwarfs backed away, but a deep voice from the doorway said, Yes, Captain Carrot. I suspect I do. Does it look like an eye with a tail? Yes, sir, said Carrot, staring. A shadow moved. It was drawn in the dark by a dying dwarf and his own blood. It is the summoning dark, Captain, and it will be moving. Good morning to you. I am Mr. Shine. Carrot's jaw dropped as the watchman turned to look at the newcomer. He loomed in the doorway, almost as broad as he was tall, in a black cloak and hood that hid any possible features. The Mr. Shine, he said. Regrettably so, Captain. And can I charge you to see that no one in this room leaves for a few minutes after I do? I like to keep my movements private. I didn't think you were real, sir. Believe me, young man, I wish it were possible to keep you in that happy state, said the hooded figure. However, my hand is forced. Mr. Shine stepped forward, pulling a mangy figure into the room. It was a troll, whose look of sullen defiance did not quite make to conceal knee-knocking terror. This is Brick, Captain. I deliver you back into the personal custody of your Sergeant Detritus. His information of use to you. I have heard his story. I believe him. You must move fast. The summoning dark may already have found a champion. What else? Oh, yes. To be sure. Be sure not to keep that symbol in a dark place. Keep light around it at all times. And now, if you'll excuse the theatricals. The black robe twitched. Hard, white, blinding light filled the room for a second. When it had gone, so had Mr. Shine. All that was left was a large round stone on the stained floor. Carrot blinked and then pulled himself together. All right, you heard, he said to the suddenly animated room at large. No one is to follow Mr. Shine, understood? Follow him, Captain, said a dwarf. We're not mad, you know. That's right, said a troll. They say he can reach inside at you and stop your heart. Mr. Shine, said Angua, is he what they've been writing about on the walls? It looks like that, said Carrot shortly. And he said we don't have much time, Mr. Brick, was it? Well, Chrysoprase's trolls had contrived to swagger while standing still. Brick just managed to huddle all alone. You usually need two to huddle, but here was a troll trying to hide behind himself. No one could hide behind Brick, for a troll. He was stick-thin to the point of knobbliness. His lichen was cheap and matted. Not the real thing at all. Probably the stuff they made up out of the broccoli stalks in the back alleys of Quarry Lane. His belt of skulls was a disgrace. Some of them were clearly the papier-mâché kind that could be bought from any joke shop. One had a red nose. He looked around nervously, and there was a thud in his as his club dropped from his fingers. "I'm in deep copra, right?" he said. "Certainly, we need to talk to you," said Carrot. "Do you want a lawyer?" "No, I ate already." "You eat lawyers?" said Carrot. Kirk gave him an empty stare until sufficient brain had been mustered. "What you call them things, they kind of crumble when you eat them," he ventured. Carrot looked at Detritus and Angua to see if there could be any help there. "Could be lawyers," he conceded. "They go soggy if you dip them in something," said Brick, as if undertaking a forensic examination. "More likely to be biscuits, then," Carrot suggested. "Could be. In a pocket with all paper on. Yeah, biscuits." "What I meant," said Carrot, "was when we talk to you, do you want someone to be on your side?" "Yes, please. Everyone," said Brick promptly. To be the center of attention in a room full of watchmen was his worst nightmare. No, hold on. What about that time when he had that bad slab had been cut with ammonium nitrate? Woo, goodbye, lobes. Yep. Then this was his second worst nightmare. No, come to think of it, there was this time when he had that stuff what Hardcore jacked off one-eyed goddamn wee ass. Who knows where that has been? All them dancing teeth. So this was his, "Hey, wait, remember that time you got lunched on scrape and your arms flew away?" Okay, that was bad. So maybe this was his, wait, of course can't be forgetting the day when you got baked on sliver and blew powdered zinc up your nose and thought you'd thrown up your feet. Arr, here comes that time again. Brick had got as far as his 19th worst nightmare before Carrot's voice cut through the snakes. "Mr. Brick, is that still me?" said Brick nervously. He could really, really do some slab right now. "Generally, your advocate is one person," said Carrot. "We're going to have to ask you some difficult questions. You're allowed to have someone to help you. Perhaps you have a friend we could fetch?" Brick pondered this. The only people he could think of in this context were Totally Slag and Big Marble, although more correctly, they fell into the category of people that don't throw things at me much and let me glom a bit of slab sometimes. Right now, these did not seem ideal qualifications. He pointed to Sergeant Detritus. "Him," he said. "He helped me find my teeth." "I'm not sure a serving officer is," Carrot began. "I'll volunteer for the role, Captain," said a little voice. Carrot peered over the edge of the desk. "Mr. Pessimal, I don't think you should be out of bed. I am, in fact, Acting Lance Constable, Captain." "And A.E. Pessimal," said A.E. Pessimal, politely yet firmly. He was on crutches. "Oh, right, said Carrot. "But I still think you shouldn't be out of bed." "Nevertheless, justice must be served," said A.E. Pessimal. Brick bent down and peered closely at the inspector. "It's that gnome from last night," he said. "Don't want him." "You can't think of anyone?" said Carrot. Brick thought again, and at last brightened up. "Yeah, I can," he said. "Easy. Someone to help me answer the questions, right?" "That's right. Well, easy peasy. If you can fetch that dwarf I saw down in that new dwarf mine last night, he'd help me." The room went deadly quiet. "And why would he do that?" said Carrot carefully. "He could tell you why he was hitting the other dwarf on the head," said Brick. "I mean, I don't know. But I expect that he won't want to come on account of me being a troll. So I'll stick with the sergeant, if it's all the same to you." "I think this is going too far, Captain," said A. Pessimal. And the silence that followed this, Carrot's voice sounded very loud. "I think this, Mr. Pessimal, is the point where we wake up Commander Vimes."